The caricature of objectivity, I think, does a lot of work in battling and arguing against the benefits of objectivity. The word objectivity is fraught. Many listeners of this conversation will say, come on, there is no objectivity. So call it fairness, call it non-predetermined conclusions, call it many, there are many synonyms that would convey the idea that the journalist's job is not to have one conclusion that they've decided beforehand and that they can't get knocked off their conclusion. You have to be curious and be able to give up your premises as you do your reporting.
And now, The Good Fight with Yascha Monk.
My guest today is Mike Pesca. Mike is the host of the podcast The Gist, which has a lovely spirit. He invites people from all over the political spectrum and pushes back on all of them in a really thorough way. We talked about the transformation of American media in general and radio in particular. Mike used to work a lot for NPR. We were then at Slate together for a little while at the same time, but he views very critically how those media platforms have evolved. We also talked about a host of other issues, including touching on the upcoming US elections and Mike interrogating me a little bit about how we should feel about the populist threat to democracy about 10 years after I first raised the alarm about it. Mike Pesca, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. I've heard dozens of these, and to be on, it's sort of a dream come true, like the time I was on Jeopardy.
You on Jeopardy?
I came in third place. I was leading going into Final Jeopardy. And, you know, it's a long story, but I wound up crossing out the answer Barbara Streisand. And at the last minute, I realized it was right, but I didn't have enough time to write Streisand. So that is my own personal Streisand effect, losing Jeopardy.
I'm really sorry to hear that. I sort of feel like I've always moved around too much to do well on a quiz show in any one country because they're quite culturally specific. Perhaps at this point, I've been in the United States long enough that I would stand a chance. But probably if I went back to Germany, for example, I would do quite badly because any German pop culture reference over the last 20 years, I would just completely miss.
There we go. We've just figured out a new game show. It's called The Internationalists, and it's people who don't have permanent citizenship anywhere. So you have to know a little bit about the English Premier League and a little bit about Bavarian hops, and then we're good.
I think if you are looking for a way to get media more hated than it already is, you've just managed to find it.
No, but then the guy who becomes the world's sweetheart is the, you know, the cop, the Bobby from London, or the Nigerian middle-class worker who just happens to know all this stuff. You know, and he shows the snooty, it's a whole slobs versus snobs thing on an international scale. I don't know if we've created a game show or a sitcom.
It would be kind of amazing to have a show where you get people from around the world discussing issues that are going on. It'd be hard to find issues that are going to be relevant to various audiences. But you find really likable people who have completely different perspectives and are just like sitting around talking about these things in a genuinely intercultural perspective, but not in a kind of feel good. I mean, it would have to be feel good in the sense that it would have to be sort of smart, likable people, but not feel good in a kind of like they all agree and hug it out, right? But they sort of go at it, but in a way that's likable. That'd be kind of fun.
As you know, I started a podcast. I have a podcast called The Gist, and it's been going on for, I don't know, maybe by the time this airs, literally 10 years. I started a podcast called Not Even Mad, and it wasn't people from around the world. It was just the classic idea of a lefty person, a righty person. I was in the center moderating, but also giving my ideas. And it didn't work. And among the reasons it didn't work, I do think the audience is there, and there's just such a lack of that kind of discussion. So the general discussion podcast with three people agreeing. But the one big reason is it didn't work is you have to do it with people who have been friends for like 10 years, right? Where the disagreements of the podcast, and then what's interesting is the groups that the three individuals or four individuals associate with, the tribes don't pull the depth of the friendship apart. That's the only way, that's the only glue to survive the dynamic of the individual tribes, you know, pulling the left from the right until it becomes acrimony.
That's interesting. So listen, we're sort of in the heart of what I want to talk to you about, which is that you're somebody who's been at NPR for a long time. NPR, for non-American listeners, is the abbreviation for National Public Radio, and it's really a very important institution in the United States, when you're publishing a book, for example, getting on the right NPR show is the thing that your publicist will worry about probably the most, more than, you know, your excerpt in the New York Times and so on and so forth. And then you've been running this debate podcast for 10 years. First at Slate, where we were contemporaries for a little while, and then under your own aegis. How has this space changed in the last 15 years? How has American journalism changed in the last 15 years? And how has NPR specifically changed? There was a much shared story by Yuri Berliner in the Free Press a little while ago. You mentioned to me that he was sometimes your editor at NPR. And he made the case that NPR has really gone from a place that always had a kind of left lean, like the New York Times had a kind of left lean, but was listened, even in the early 2010s, was listened to by a very broad range of people ideologically. A lot of moderates, a lot of conservatives used to listen to NPR, and the station tried to portray the world in a kind of balanced way. And now the listenership to NPR has not only reduced, but it has come to skew very, very liberal, and in fact, very, very far left, according to surveys. And Yuri Berliner says that this is because NPR has kind of given up on some of the core mission of what public radio used to be. You know, as somebody who was at NPR for a long time in a prominent position, what do you make of that?
I think there was a conscious choice to change and then just running along with the river, the stream of societal change, but not really recognizing how much the waters had increased their rapidity. So what I mean by that is NPR, you're right, it was always a liberal place, you know, liberal in both the best sense, but also, you know, that was its lean. I would seriously doubt that if you surveyed the people who worked at NPR and said, who'd you vote for since the time of their founding, which was during the Watergate trials, to the time I left, you'd get more than, you know, any Republican presidential candidate getting maybe 10%, maybe 15% of the vote. But that's not the end-all be-all of the definition of journalism. And the best anecdote I tell about this is my longtime colleague and head of the New York Bureau was a woman named Margot Adler. And Margot was, I don't know if they have a real hierarchy of this, but she was essentially the chief Wiccan goddess of the United States. She was a big Wiccan. And not to stereotype, she also had the politics of what you expect a Wiccan would have. And she was into protest. Testing, and she was into activism, and she found it all delightful. But she reported, you would listen to her reports, and you wouldn't be shocked to know that Margot had been to many, many protest marches in the 60s, but she played it straight in her reports. Part of that was she had editors who, if she would ever go over the line, would pull her back. And part of that was that she knew, and whatever over the line was, she knew and appreciated that she was operating in this system. And I think she also appreciated, she has since passed away, the fact that the editors were there to buttress her credibility. And she also was a great storyteller and someone who was really curious about all aspects of the human condition. I don't know who the equivalent or what the equivalent of Margot Adler would be today, but I do think that she would be, or that kind of person would not have the editorial oversight. And the message wouldn't be that you have to put on a radio broadcast that could very much appeal to people who disagree with you. That whole idea is out. And part of that is the people when I was there in 2020, 2007, 2012, people who disagreed with you were, or who might be listening to NPR, were something like a Mitt Romney Republican or a professor at the university who was a professor of business and had Republican leanings but was a smart, curious person. Now, I think the conception is, and it's changed a bit, that the person who disagrees with you, if you are presenting progressive-coded content, is a crazy insurrectionist who owns a number of assault rifles, and you don't care at all about their opinion. And if that is the person that you're quote-unquote trying to appeal to, I understand jettisoning the idea or the ideal of, oh, let's say some things that a conspiracy theorist would like. But what I think is, and this is one of the reasons why, say, local news has been hurt so much and that the splintering of news and the siloing of news and the ideological silos hurt us is, you know, it used to be the case that if you were the Sacramento Bee and you put out your paper, it was going to be read by, even if you had a mostly liberal editorial slant, it was going to be read by everyone in the community. And if you said crazy things that offended the business owners, like if you had many articles valorizing the idea of defunding the police, you were going to upset your very reasonable members of the community. Now, I think that members of the community, the people who do the radio and do media are mostly younger. They've ingested ideas of activism that I think go against traditional media, and I know you've talked about this. The older editors who were raised in a system where there was such an idea as if we don't call it, we don't have to call it objectivity, but there was a fairness and there was an ideal of even the person who disagrees with you, are they going to recognize the truth in that? They've been cowed. Part of this was the tumult of Trump. A greater accelerant was the 2020 George Floyd protests. But it came to a situation where NPR really stopped caring about being believable to anyone outside. And this is not always true, but it is true in many cases. They stopped caring about being credible and believable to people who weren't very much ideologically captured by what we could say is a progressive ideology. One more point. You could say the Democratic Party, you know, there's another thesis about this, and this is probably true with Slate. I used to always say, well, Slate was always somewhere where the Democratic Party was, and as the Democratic Party got more left, let's say Slate got more left. The thing is, there are ways, there are elections, and what elections do is it actually in some way inserts the truth about where the public really is. So in 2020, the theory of the Democratic Party was everyone was positioning themselves to the left of everyone else, and there was one guy who didn't do it, and it was Joe Biden. He got the election. He got the nomination.
My line about Joe Biden for a long time has been that he became the nominee of the Democratic Party and then president because he was too old to get with a program. Everybody else, like the smart money of the Democratic Party was you have to compete for votes on Twitter and outbid all the other competitors with how far left you are. And, you know, Joe Biden just didn't get the memo and wasn't able to do it. And so he was the last man standing in the sort of moderate center-left space. And boom, he became the nominee despite being scoffed at by the establishment of a party, actually, and certainly the media establishment.
He didn't evolve. And I don't know if this is true, but in zoology, there's this idea of the Irish elk that it evolved, its antlers grew so big that it could no longer lift its head and it died out. It's probably a folktale, but as an analogy, right, sometimes you can evolve, quote unquote, so much that you write the tale of your destruction.
Here's another analogy while we're at it. There's a kind of slightly apocryphal story about the effect of the 2008 financial crisis on various types of banks. And broadly speaking, the idea was, you know, if you're Goldman, you really know what's going on and you're plugged in enough and smart enough to get rid of all of those subprime mortgages before the music stops. So you get through the crisis sort of okay. If you're a German bank, you're sort of plugged into the international financial system enough that you know you can like fly over to New York and your colleagues from Goldman are going to give you a great time and take you out for a lovely dinner and possibly to a strip club. And then they'll sell you a bunch of goods that they say are amazing, but you're not clued in enough to realize that they're actually really not very good goods. And so some of those banks really ended up in trouble because they got stuck holding the bag. Then there's the Italian banks that were so out of the loop, they didn't even know they could go to New York and have a good time and be sold the bad goods. And so they actually came out ahead in some ways. And perhaps Joe Biden is like an Italian bank.
That's a good analogy. But unfortunately, both of our analogies, zoological and monetary, are perhaps a little apocryphal. But they do, right, underline the point that, and this is what happened with NPR. NPR lost 30% of its listenership. All media has suffered to some extent. But if you look at, compare radio to radio, the radio listenership of, say, Sean Hannity, who had the most popular radio show before 2019, still is the most popular radio show, and it's still around 16 million listeners, right? Others have fallen off. Dave Ramsey has done a little bit better. My point is, drive time radio listenership overall has fallen, but it hasn't fallen by 20%. And if NPR wanted to replace, there's a logic. This is not the logic of politics or of most media where younger is better in terms of advertising, but in terms of what NPR is doing and just in terms of audience. If you want to replace every 60-year-old with a 30-year-old, that makes good business sense. Even if you want to replace every 60-year-old with 0.8 30-year-olds, you're doing yourself a favor. But they didn't do that. There's no evidence that they're getting younger was anything other than jettisoning, lopping off like cream from the top, the older listeners or the listeners who have been with it a long time.
And one of the striking things, which of course goes to the popular misconception about, you know, what I call the identity trap or the identity synthesis, the ideology that has led us into this trap, is that NPR wanted to diversify its audience and its listenership. And that makes sense given the changing demographics of the United States. But they haven't actually succeeded in doing so. So they've managed to attract an audience that is much more ideological. So it's less diverse in ideological terms because it skews much more towards the left and the far left. But they haven't meaningfully managed to diversify the audience in ethnic terms. It's still overwhelmingly white.
That's true. But this is the interesting thing. Some of their press materials, and I've actually seen this at the member station, so NPR is a complicated structure, but they do brag that our audience has gotten more diverse. But that is, I see no evidence contradicting the analysis that that is entirely a function of the older and whiter audience just leaving. So congratulations, your audience got more diverse, but you didn't add a discernible number. You certainly didn't replace the old audience as the aggregate numbers show, but you also didn't really diversify in the best sense of the term. Diversification isn't just throwing away a bunch of older white people who used to like you and now don't.
So here's one thing I was puzzling about. If you're looking at different media outlets that go in a much more progressive direction. There's a normative point of view and a business point of view. From a normative point of view, I worry about the New York Times basically becoming the mouthpiece of the 5 million subscribers to the New York Times who are, you know, among the more progressive people in the country. Even for even they, if you look at readers' comments on various quote-unquote woke New York Times articles, are well to the center or well to the right, if you want, of the average New York Times writer, which is interesting in itself. So I worry about the way in which the New York Times ceases to be a newspaper of record and becomes more like a more successful version of a Guardian, like a fulsome voice of the American left, just because I think that we need some newspaper of record, some outlet that actually is able to be a fair arbiter and that has some amount of respect in different realms of the United States, including among moderates and including among the center-right. And so I worry that the New York Times is giving up on that very important historical role. But in a purely business sense, what the New York Times has done seems to be working very well. They have a lot of subscribers. A lot of them have come from other daily newspapers that are declining as a result. But it has managed to build a bigger newsroom, cover more things in many ways, add cooking and games and other kinds of things, which is part of its appeal. But it's thriving as a business. So you've got to give it to them in that sense. NPR is not thriving. It is losing audience. Why is that? Now, one difference is that the New York Times now has to compete with Substack. But perhaps that's not the same kind of competition. NPR now has to compete with podcasts like this podcast and your podcast, right? Like a lot of high information people don't want to switch on the radio and, you know, listen to whatever is being told to them. They say, hey, I know exactly what kind of show I want and when I want to listen to it. And I want to be able to press pause and resume it. And the easiest way to do that is to go to podcasts, which NPR didn't manage to corner. I think there's a second reason as well, for which is that I am annoyed by the New York Times a good part of the time. But I subscribe to the New York Times. I'm a subscriber and I read the New York Times. And when I want to know what's going on in the world, I still go to nytimes.com or to the app. So even though there are things about it that I find to be irksome, it creates a product that I can actually still be on board with, right? Despite my objections, I pay them my money and I pay them my money for a reason, right? NPR somehow I find harder to listen to. And I found a few friends who've said the same thing. There's something about the moralizing and lecturing tone of NPR that's somehow worse than the New York Times. And I'm having trouble putting my finger on where exactly that difference lies. Is it just having somebody in your ear saying stuff that you find ideologically annoying? Is that somehow worse than like seeing somebody on the page? Or is it that there's sort of two different gradations here, where the New York Times has sort of veered from the historical role it's played, but it still is living up to some kind of standards, and the opinion pages run some stuff that I think is silly, but also some stuff that I think is very good. And NPR is more one note, it is more monochrome, it is more extreme in how it perceives the world through an ideological lens. Help me puzzle through the difference that rightly or wrongly I perceive between something like the New York Times and NPR.
First of all, on the monetary front or on the success, on the question of why is the New York Times, perhaps alone Wall Street Journal, also been a successful news organization, there's the idea of network effects, and as other news organizations fail, one will rise and they're able to hire all the best people from the other news organizations who are out there because they're done. We also can't overlook the fact that everything we're talking about, maybe we're going to talk about journalism, we're going to talk about audience capture, we're going to talk about all these concepts. It might redound to just Wordle, and some cooking apps. Like, those have been extremely successful for the New York Times, and the subscription model has supplanted the advertising model. So, but for Wordle, it is possible that none of the stuff, the praise I'm about to give to the New York Times will be true as this successful business model. But the big reason, I think there is something about the amount of breath that a huge newspaper and the, you know, amount of articles that the Sunday New York Times can do, the length of the articles, a radio piece. I have friends who are a married couple, and one was a radio reporter and one was a print reporter, and they would both cover the same thing. The print reporter would file a 2,000-word piece and be, or maybe a 1,500-word piece, and be in bed by midnight. The radio reporter would work for 2 days on that, and it would come out to the equivalent of 500 words. So just less information, although the texture and maybe the human feel is different from a radio piece. But I think the biggest thing is that the New York Times, specifically, after going through a lot of tumult at the same time that NPR and other news organizations did, the New York Times made a lot of mistakes and they fired James Bennett, but then they pulled back. And I think it was a monetary consideration. I think it was a business consideration. But, you know, A.G. Sulzberger, the publisher, last year, about a year ago today, wrote in the Columbia Journalism Review an article called Journalism's Essential Value. And he essentially embraced objectivity. There was a lot of time being spent about how the problems with objectivity, the history of objectivity, the word objectivity, he rebranded it as some multi-hyphenate, multi-syllabic phrase. But they've essentially said, in order to work with the trust of the audience that we've always had, we have to get back to an idea very close to, perhaps in different clothing, but very close to objectivity. We have to do this for our audience. We have to do this for believability. They've changed the comportment and composure of the op-ed page to reflect that. So there was a reckoning, or you'd call it a counter-reckoning, within the New York Times. The opposite, I think, has taken place at NPR. I don't have extreme visibility. But all they seem to do publicly, and they don't have a family owner, they don't have one CEO, they cycle through CEOs and even leaders of the newsroom, but they have mostly talked about diversity being their North Star. If you said the word or phrase North Star in NPR, everyone know, that's our diversity initiative. And they've been successful at that. Good, I say. As far as objectivity, they just reject the premise, from what I could tell. They have done, I'm going to do a piece on The Gist about this. They've done many, many segments over the years questioning the idea of objectivity. It's kind of a straw man at its worst form to say, well, no human being can be objective. Therefore, we have to get rid of the idea that we're going to do our journalism with the idea of impartiality or fairness or all these other fought over phrases in mind. But they really think, it seems to me, that the people who make the editorial decisions really think that there is an inherent problem with the old ideas of objectivity, whereas the New York Times knows that the word objectivity will get attacked. And in journalism schools, it doesn't matter what you call it, that whole idea of objectivity will get attacked. But they've gotten down to, they've returned to their roots, and their editor has embraced that.
For people who are less in the weeds about this debate, let's delve into it a little bit and give a little bit of context. Obviously, there was always an idea of trying to describe the world in academia or in journalism as it is. You know, there's an old concept in a certain kind of historiographical school of how historians should comport themselves, which is to write history, wie es eigentlich gewesen, as it really was. The old slogan of the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, has a kind of whiff of that, I think. Now, this standard of objectivity was held very high in American newsrooms in particular. I think English newspapers always had a slightly more partisan tradition and lean. There's always been a slightly different approach, with the important exception of the BBC that had a legal mandate, form of neutrality. But it came under attack in two kinds of ways, I think, right? The first is that the imperative to objectivity could lead to a slightly silly kind of two sides reporting that didn't really help the reader understand debates, right? So if you had a conversation about climate change, you would just always find people on two sides of the issue, right? So you write a story about climate change, you have to find, this is the caricature at least, somebody who says climate change is real and somebody who says climate change is not real. And it doesn't matter whether the position that says climate change is not real is scientifically serious or not. The way you approach it is simply to have one voice in one direction, one voice in the other direction. There's obviously something formulaic about this. It often, I think, makes for not very good journalism. It makes for difficulty of readers actually understanding the situation. So that was one line of attack. And then the second line of attack came particularly after the election of Donald Trump, where objectivity was contrasted with a call for moral clarity. And the idea here was that journalists should fight for the right moral causes and let that moral clarity inflect everything they're doing. Now, of course, the concerns with that is two things. First, what does moral clarity actually mean, right? That goes beyond we want to be factual, and being factual doesn't always mean having equal opinion quotes from two sides. It means actually helping readers understand the lay of the land, right? Moral clarity means I have my values and I'm going to impose them on the reader. And a lot of the time, the reader's values will be different from that of a journalist. And so that starts to feel very lecturing and cloying. The second problem is that I think it often makes people mistrust what journalists do. I think a lot of journalists have gotten into the habit of framing every piece about Donald Trump, for example, or about an upcoming election, or about some other issue of genuine political concern, with the thought of how do I get the reader to take the right conclusion from that. And I think that's often self-undermining. So I, in 2016 and 2017, was very worried about the rise of populism and the election of Donald Trump, and I continue to be very worried about those things. And I certainly wanted newspapers to pay attention to that topic, to take seriously the ways in which democracy might be undermined by these kind of political movements. I didn't think then, I certainly don't think now, that news reporters thinking to themselves every time they cover a Trump press conference, how can I make sure that the way I cover this event is going to make people not vote for Donald Trump so we save our democracy, is in purely instrumental terms, leave alone the normative element of it for a moment, a good way of ensuring that people don't vote for Donald Trump. Because what people actually do is to recognize, hey, you're not talking about certain things because you worry it's going to lead me to a wrong conclusion. You're framing things in a very heavy-handed way, in such a way that I come to the right conclusion. And actually, all that leads up to is to me mistrusting the way you're trying to manipulate me. And so I worry that many journalists, most famously in the case of the Washington Post, adopting the slogan "Democracy dies in darkness," sort of coming to think of their own goal as saving democracy, has actually undermined the cause for democracy. And it's not because I disagree with them about the urgency of protecting democracy or the nobility of trying to do something to save democracy. I just think that we have a division of labor in society, and the job of reporters, the best way they can serve democracy is to tell it straight, is to actually analyze what's going on, is to actually allow readers to help understand what's going on, not to frame exactly how they should perceive things. How do you think we should approach objectivity? How can we have a standard in journalism that takes our, especially in the reporting business, not in the opinion business, but takes our duty to the reader seriously without falling in some of the genuine traps that I think an older style of journalism sometimes had, like the let's just find voices on each side and not really analyze it too carefully.
Right. The caricature of objectivity, I think, does a lot of work in battling and arguing against the benefits of objectivity. The word objectivity is fraught. Many listeners of this conversation will say, come on, there is no objectivity. So call it fairness, call it non-predetermined conclusions, call it many, there are many synonyms that would convey the idea that the journalist's job is not to have one conclusion that they've decided beforehand and that they can't get knocked off their conclusion. You have to be curious and be able to give up your premises as you do your reporting. There is a problem, I think, in that there is a disconnect between the public and the press. And I don't think the public is totally right on this. When Pew asked people, journalists should always strive to give every side equal coverage versus every side does not always deserve equal coverage. Journalists, 55 to 44%, said every side does not always deserve equal coverage. I would answer that. That would be my answer, because I would think of exactly the climate change example that you're talking about. U.S. adults say, 76% say, journalists should always strive to give every side equal coverage. Because I think people who just look to journalists as, oh, please tell me what is true, please tell me the news, they're not thinking of every exception to the rule of equal coverage. They're thinking, in general, do I want to know why Joe Biden, or if Joe Biden, constitutionally, unconstitutionally, legally, correctly, reduced student loan debt, right? And so they want a story that says, hey, Joe Biden did this. Here are the political reasons. Here are the beneficiaries. But also, here's the argument that it might not pass muster. That's the kind of article they want. There are thousands of articles and topics where the ideal news consumer, who I think is still out there but is a little turned off by how news is churned out, want that kind of coverage. Even if the war, many partisans will want to know why the aid convoy was hit in Israel, what mistakes Israel made. Maybe they'd want reporting to say that, you know, these mistakes were guaranteed to happen by the flaws of the Israeli system. Some newsreaders will say, or some newsreaders will not want both sides of that, right? They will not either want to hear that Israel made a mistake, or they will not want to hear that Israel was acting legitimately at all. I think it's the duty of the real news reporter to do in that side both sides or all sides. And it's not both sidesism. Both sidesism has been, I think, politically anathemized and weaponized to make it seem like if you articulate a view of someone who, I don't know, for instance, thinks that there really was no great evidence that Donald Trump was marching to the Kremlin's orders when it comes to election interference, put that case on. Give that person airing. It's not as if there's absolutely nothing to that point of view. I think especially in that case, a little bit with the Wuhan virus, there have been a lot of high-profile stories where the idea of, well, we don't have to engage in both sidesism because we know the truth. And then you're exposed as, oh, we got the truth, quote unquote, a little wrong. It seems like the public is more correct than journalists when they want more both sides or all sides or a better rounded out story. I mean, even though I would side with the majority of U.S. journalists that say every side doesn't always deserve equal coverage. That's true. But in general, your default setting as a journalist should be humble to know that the narrative or the agreed upon frame isn't necessarily correct. You also have to do a lot of work to, you know, not air things that seem to have absolutely no basis to them. I think that the idea of objectivity is sort of like the idea of kindness, right? You could always say there's no agreed upon definition. And what a lot of journalists have done is sort of, I think, like a radical reconsideration of some basic ideals that has definitely hurt journalism.
Yeah, I mean, a few points here, right? Like, one is just, it's a very, very weird confusion in the debate where the impossibility of fully reaching a certain kind of normative standard is a reason not to aspire to that standard at all. I try to be kind in my personal interactions. I don't always succeed in being kind in my personal interactions. That's not a reason to say kindness is a bad standard to try and hold yourself to.
And this is true of every societal endeavor, right? Justice, fairness. These are all baked into what we do as societies. And you're right, there's no agreed upon definition. It doesn't mean that we should, you know, decarcerate or have no concept of justice. I'll give you an example of, I've been doing some research and I'm trying to remember some of the more egregious examples in media where I think they went off the rails. So there was a producer for an NPR show called 1A, and he, as a producer, without permission, started tweeting, Donald Trump is a fascist. And it caused a little bit of a kerfuffle, should a producer say this. So the program 1A did a whole show where they had the PBS ombudsman, they had Nicole Hannah-Jones, and they had this producer, essentially all agreeing with each other, and the host did, that there is no objectivity, there is no such, or the objectivity that we once decided on was like a white person's objectivity, and it didn't take into account the perspectives of the market. marginalized. I think everyone in the conversation, I think the PBS ombudsman's Latino and everyone else was black. So what the journalist said or what the producer said was, the reason I said Donald Trump is a fascist is because it is the truth that Donald Trump is a fascist. Because I have done the reading and I have learned that what fascism means, and that's why we say it as journalists. We have to say the truth. I have unlearned, he used the word unlearned a couple times. I have unlearned the thinking that would lead me to a different conclusion, and this is why we must say it. No one on the show disagreed with him. And that, I think, is exactly the problem, that if we embolden that kind of thinking, which is not if Trump was or wasn't a fascist, but the thinking that what journalists should be doing is coming out and saying the fascist president, Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because they've learned it and because it's the truth, it is going to do nothing but degrade and destroy the credibility of news organizations. And they haven't done that. Like, you can mention Donald Trump without saying the fascist Donald Trump, but they've gone 80-something percent of the way there. And I think that that does degrade trust, and not just with Trump, with many, many issues.
Yeah, and part of this is a kind of illusion of omnipotence among journalists. So one concern I have is that, you know, there's many, many, many things for which there was good reason to criticize Donald Trump. And there's many, many reasons to worry about what will happen if Donald Trump becomes president again in 2024. The fact that media outlets can't restrain themselves from also criticizing him in ways that are very dubious, from also pretending that he said things that he didn't really say, makes people not listen to the real criticisms of it, right? So one recent example was when Donald Trump was talking about the competition economically from Mexico and the fact that there's many cars now produced in Mexico rather than the United States and then being sent across the border. And he said, in that context, you know, if Biden gets elected, there's going to be a bloodbath. And clearly what he meant was a lot of American auto workers would lose their jobs, which is, by the way, itself a very, very dubious claim, right? I don't buy what he was saying. Media outlets would have been perfectly justified in saying it's ridiculous to think that, you know, the American economy is going to be decimated if Biden gets reelected and somehow if Trump gets elected, miraculously everybody is going to work in auto manufacturing. Would have been decent ways to criticize it in a factual way. But instead, a lot of mainstream outlets, including, I believe, both NPR and the New York Times, quoted this in headlines in ways that strongly implied Trump was saying, if I don't get elected, my followers are going to ensure that there's a bloodbath in the streets of the United States, a kind of veiled threat as to what would happen to the country if he wasn't elected. Now, some of these reports in the 10th or 15th paragraph provided a little bit of a context. So, you know, for the small percentage of people who clicked on the headline and got down to the second half of the article, it might to some extent have been rectified in their initial impression. But that, I think, is deeply irresponsible, in part because it makes criticisms of Trump less effective. But the second point here is that journalists, I think, genuinely have this idea that, you know, if we don't talk about uncomfortable topics, if we don't talk about ways in which perhaps some of the aspects of a trans debate are more complicated than it meets the eye, the way in which perhaps Democrats have made some genuine mistakes when it comes to inflation or other topics, right? If we don't talk about this stuff, if we somehow take it off the table, then nobody's going to know. And if we frame things in the right way for our readers, if we say the fascist Donald Trump, then people will understand he's a fascist and nobody's going to vote for him anymore, right? And I think it's just hugely overestimating the power of journalists and the stupidity of the audience. Because the audience realizes when somebody is hiding the ball. The audience realizes when they're being manipulated. And their response tends to be either to just switch off the medium, go to a different medium, which is often worse, which is often a less mainstream medium that actually has stronger biases in its own right. But a lot of the time, I'll actually go to things that are much less intellectually serious and rigorous and honest as a result. Or they simply conclude the opposite. They say, well, look, if you're trying to manipulate me like that, perhaps actually the opposite is true.
Right. And the audience that's left in the case of all of our fractured cable audiences are the audiences that buy into it. And then you just serve them and you get captured by the audience that's using your service, not so much to hear about the news, but to assuage their anxiety about where they put their finger on as the state of the world, right? Fox News exists to assuage the anxiety of Republicans about immigration, and MSNBC exists to assuage the anxiety of liberals about the racism of Republicans, among other things. The bloodbath issue is really interesting because at that same speech that he said bloodbath, and it was taken out of context, he also led that speech with his hand over the heart, playing of the national anthem as sung by January 6th insurrectionists from prison, who he called hostages. The thing is, that has been reported before, so you can't say, or you can, but it wouldn't be a good news story, for the eighth day in a row or for the 12th rally in a row, Donald Trump played people who he called hostages who have been adjudicated as insurrectionists and held his hand over his heart as they played the national anthem, right? It's a conundrum, and Donald Trump knows about this conundrum, and he knows how to take offense at any misstatement or mischaracterization of anything he said. So you can't say that Donald Trump told the Proud Boys to storm the Capitol, but you can say by his ambiguity, either strategic or just like the lucky guy he is, always falling into shit and finding gold, by saying stand down and stand by, he communicated to each audience something ambiguous that wound up being dangerous. Bloodbath also specifically, it wasn't just a mischaracterization. And sometimes Trump is mischaracterized. Is he mischaracterized more than other politicians? I don't know. I bet you if you asked Obama, who probably, I would say, got the best news coverage of any politician, major politician in my lifetime, he would say, oh my God, the media mischaracterized me so often. But the very point of bloodbath and insurrection goes exactly to this tension that I did want to ask you about, which is 2 books ago, you raised the point of our democracy being in peril. But then 1 book ago, which is true, and I agree to it to some extent, 1 book ago, it was about the mindset that has overtaken much of academia, but also much of the media. And I would say the consequence of that is polarization. MSNBC, which I watch and monitor, is both a major source of raising the salient question of our democracy being in peril. It's not untrue that a Trump election will be bad for democracy. I don't know the death knell, but bad. So MSNBC is very good, I guess, or consistent on that front. But on the other hand, I think they're a deeply polarizing force. Not that Fox isn't, okay? But they're a deeply polarizing force because if there ever is any right winger with a gun who either shoots at an FBI headquarters through thick glass that doesn't hurt anyone, then gets killed, I'm not going to say wall-to-wall covered, but covered extensively on MSNBC about look at these right-wingers imperiling democracy. And I think the idea of right-wingers with guns imperiling democracy who want to kill you, who want to kill your family, is so prevalent there, it leads to polarization. And I think that they've done a disservice when it comes to that. And you could say they haven't done as much of a disservice as Fox has. I'll concede the point, but I think they've done a disservice. And their ratings are twice as big as CNN's. And I think that's a big problem with our country and with the mindset of a lot of people who identify as fair-minded, liberal, not necessarily entirely progressive Democrats, but they really, really do think that we're on the verge of a civil war. So you can worry about democracy, but also think these claims about a civil war are totally overblown and really destructive to the project of depolarization.
Yes, I agree with all of that. I can see how there's a superficial tension between my third book, The People vs. Democracy, and my latest, my fifth book, The Identity Trap. I think there is a tension between those two, but I don't think they're contradictory in any way, right? So it's both true that there are dangerous authoritarian populists around the world, some of whom are on the left, but many of whom and most of whom are on the right, and that a lot of this political moment requires us to beat those political forces in order to defend democratic institutions. And Donald Trump is perhaps the prime example of that kind of right-wing populist. And I do worry about the way in which he attacked independent political institutions in his first term in office. And I worry very much that he's going to do that with more effectiveness and more vindictiveness in his potential second term in office if he gets reelected in November 2024. At the same time, I worry that in part because of the shock of his victory, an ideology has come to be so influential in big parts of the mainstream that it's actually harder to beat him. I think a lot of the reason, even in 2016, I think a little bit of a reason why he won was that some of these ideas were starting to spread. I've taught many times the essay by Michael Anton called The Flight 93 Election, which was a key document in moving conservatives, movement conservatives, more traditional conservatives, towards Donald Trump in the fall of 2016. And what struck me about that text when I was first teaching it, because I think it's such an interesting exhibit of how Trump was able to broaden and rally support, was his lines about immigration. So he has a line where he says, you know, the ceaseless, quote unquote, the ceaseless importation of third world foreigners is going to make America less smaller Republican and less capital R Republican over time. So this is an existential threat to our Republican system of government. And that's why, even though we don't know whether or not Donald Trump can fly the plane, we should put him in the cockpit and see what happens, the way that the passengers of Flight 93 on 9/11 stormed the cockpit. It's really quite a gruesome metaphor. Rereading the essay recently when I was teaching it again, I was struck that even at the time, some of the concerns were actually about cultural overreach on the left. So I think it played some role in 2016. I think it plays a much bigger role today. Right? Like, one of the reasons why Republicans are making huge inroads, especially among non-white voters, is that so many of them are deeply put off by the quote-unquote wokeness in NPR and the New York Times that we're talking about, and in parts of the Democratic Party. And so I think if we actually want to beat populists like that, we have to make sure that our mainstream institutions and make sure that non-populist political parties don't get taken over by this ideology. That's a broader point. The more narrower point relates to what I was saying earlier about journalists not taking on the role of democracy defenders, right? I think it's fine to have a broader conception of one of the things I want to do in life and as a citizen is to defend democracy. I certainly think of myself in those terms. It's even fine to say we have a division of labor in society, and one of the key ways in which we defend democracy is to have good journalists who do good jobs as a journalist. And therefore, I take some professional pride in what I do because I think it's part of the maintenance of democratic norms. That's also fine. When you're sitting down and saying, how do I frame the story about Hunter Biden's laptop? Or how do I frame the story about the origin of a coronavirus in such a way that I'm defending democracy? Then I think you are actually coming to be actively harmful to that effort. And I would go one step further, which is that I think a lot of journalists have fallen into that trap. I think some political scientists have too. I was very saddened when many of my genuine friends and colleagues, some people who I deeply respect and admire, signed onto a letter, I think it was in the days after Joe Biden won the 2020 election, perhaps it was briefly before, demanding that Democrats abolish the filibuster as a matter of democratic theory, right? If you want to have a democracy, you have to abolish the filibuster. Now, I'm not deeply wedded to the filibuster. I think there's some good reasons to get rid of the filibuster. I also am far from certain that this would be in the long run in the interest, certainly of a Democratic Party or of democratic stability, because after all, the Senate favors Republicans in its current shape, and that probably makes people like Trump more powerful on average when we don't have a filibuster. You can have debates about one way or the other, but to have all of the leading political scientists, and really was signed by just about every major political scientist in the country, minus me, because I didn't sign it, I refused to sign it, saying, you know, we as experts and political scientists are saying that to serve the cause of democracy, the Democratic Party has to do this thing that happens to be in its partisan interest in order to pass laws that, you know, we all happen to agree with. I thought there was one worrying indication of a way in which the field of political science has gone in the wrong direction. The academy does remain a good place for having serious intellectual debates, despite all of its shortcomings. But I do worry about that development in the field, and especially among the most audible voices within the field. So I agree with you, and I would even take it beyond the realm of journalism.
I want to ask you a question. Did you not want to sign the filibuster is the death knell of democracy or needs to be abolished article because you had some disagreements with the analysis, or you don't think it's the proper place of a political scientist to have that sort of decree?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's take back a couple of steps. One is, I certainly don't think that academics, including political scientists, need to pretend not to have values or to be neutral in that kind of sense. It's perfectly fine for them to be very active as citizens fighting for political causes, whether they're mainstream political causes or whether they're less mainstream political causes. All of that right to have that form of political engagement does not go out of a window just because you also happen to have a day job as a political scientist. The second point is that I think when you are speaking as an expert, right, when you're speaking with a professional hat on, from a point of view that should aspire to a certain kind of academic grounding, and if you want to use that word, to a certain kind of objectivity, you want to be very, very careful that you're not letting your activist point of view color what you're telling people from on high. So I have no problem with an individual political scientist writing an op-ed saying, here's why I think abolishing the filibuster would, on the whole, be good for democracy. I might disagree with that, but I think the standard for putting that forward as an individual opinion is a little bit lower. I think once you're saying, here is an open letter from 50 of the most distinguished political scientists today, and we're telling you as experts that objectively speaking, abolishing the filibuster is what we need to do in order to save American democracy. The language probably wasn't quite as stark as that, but that is certainly the impression that the letter was trying to convey. You better be damn sure. I mean, that better have a very high epistemic standard, especially if it so happens that 49.9 out of those 50 political scientists also think that abolishing the filibuster would happen to be in the partisan interest of a political party that they, like me, prefer in this particular historical juncture. And I just felt that that letter fell short of that epistemic standard, that certainly, look, the filibuster is not written into the Constitution. It used to be a very rare thing. It's now become something very routine. There is a counter-majoritarian element to the Senate, which was part of its design, but that is slightly troubling in the way it's playing out these days. Perhaps actually political systems that have too many veto points become too stuck, and that can actually grow the appetite for a strongman leader. These are all good reasons to abolish the filibuster that I think are legitimate. On the other side, though, it's also the case that a veto point is quite a useful thing to have when you have authoritarian populists possibly come back to office. And nobody was thinking about Trump getting back in office in December of 2020. But lo and behold, we're now in a situation where it looks like the chance is at least about 50% that he might be very soon. So perhaps it's a good thing that the filibuster is still around. He might abolish it if he wins the Senate, etc. Still, good thing that, you know, for now we have a filibuster that's at least going to be one more roadblock, making it harder for Donald Trump to do whatever he wants. I don't think that people thought seriously about the fact that because the Senate skews Republican, it actually is as likely to undermine the causes of Democrats as it is to serve them. I think there's some background theory that political scientists have that it's very hard to pass certain things like expansions of a welfare state, but it's very hard. But once you've passed them, they never get repealed. And so therefore, a Senate filibuster skews conservative because it makes it harder to put things in place, but nobody's going to repeal them anyway. I'm not at all sure that is the case. I think there's going to be a lot of destructive work that happens if Trump wins a trifecta in a way that political scientists didn't anticipate. So was it okay for a public health official in May or June of 2020 to go on the streets and join the George Floyd protests? Sure, depending on what other kind of pronouncements they did in the days leading up to that protest, if they're not completely contradicting other things they said themselves, for them to go and join those protests in a personal capacity, absolutely fine. Was it okay for public health officials, academics and researchers and so on to do a big open letter saying that, you know, after they told people they can't attend funerals and we have to have very extreme lockdowns, it is in fact good from the point of view of public health to go join mass demonstrations over George Floyd? No, there they were just straying very far from what in their capacity as public health officials they should have told us. I worry in a milder form that my genuinely dear friends and colleagues who signed this letter about the filibuster made a similar mistake.
Yeah. And you could say, was it right for 51 intelligence officials to say that the Hunter Biden laptop was likely the source of foreign intelligence? Maybe when the standard there is if they're right, if they're sure they're right. But you were saying something different. You articulated very eloquently an epistemic principle. And for you, it didn't clear that bar. Do you think your fellow academics, most of them, all of them, for them, it did clear the bar of a similar principle, or they just don't have that same epistemic principle? And the reason I ask is, I think, and I'm not in the academy, but I just read about it, I think the ship has sailed on ideas like our job is to describe the world as it is, not as we wish it would be. I think the ship has sailed. Maybe it's department by department or discipline by discipline. But when I read stories about the fight to include ethnic studies in California, and California wanted a descriptive approach to here was the experience of the Asians, or, you know, the Chinese, the Japanese, here was the experience of the Latinos, and the head of ethnic studies at the University of California, Riverside, defines his field as not a descriptive curriculum that speaks to various ethnic and racial groups' experience. That is a bland form of multiculturalism. He defines the discipline as a critical analysis of the way power works in society. I read that as saying they're out of the game of description and they are consciously activist. I perceive most of the academy, the social sciences, the humanities, as being in that camp. I don't think journalism is yet, but I want to just backtrack half a step and saying, am I right about the academy? They're now explicitly activist and the descriptivist role is just a relic of the past?
You know, I might disagree, actually. So it's certainly true of big corners of the academy, and I'm very, very worried about that. And what you're saying about, you know, that ethnic studies curriculum, particularly in California, is, you know, one of the really dangerous examples of how that form of activism just leads to the imposition of pure ideology in pedagogical settings in ways that I'm very concerned about. The people who signed this particular petition do not have a mind frame. They're not woke ideologues. And many of them, I know privately, have serious misgivings about woke ideology. And I certainly think that they can have a mission that I share in a certain sense of trying to save democracy. But they're not, I don't think most of them would consider themselves activists in that kind of way. And I don't think they are activists. They're people whose judgment I trust in general and who I think are doing some of the most important work in helping us understand the state of democracy and other political questions around the world. I do think that there is a danger of groupthink.
You talked about the political ramifications of the media and Democrats disgusting the people who are maybe swing voters or don't share those particular cultural concerns, and it creates the opening for Donald Trump. And you talked about the Anton essay, and your analysis was this gives fertile ground for people who might be voting against Democrats. Would you say that, in an irony, the luxury or the leeway to use your vote to give the middle finger to the culturalism of the left is because of the successes of Joe Biden's or the Democrats' policies, materially speaking? In other words, Donald Trump was voted out of office when the economy seemed horrible, when the pandemic was raging, when it seemed as if his leadership was not directing the country in a way that Americans could live with. Now that things have been stabilized and that Biden let's just say the Democrats, even the Democrats who operated within the filibuster to pass the Infrastructure Act, now that they have calmed things down and wages are up and unemployment is down, provided all those good things, that's where the cultural play can affect people's votes and they could give the middle finger with their vote instead of using the vote just to get the benefits of democracy.
That's a really interesting theory. I mean, certainly there's a question about, more broadly, why is it that economic questions were at the forefront of politics in the post-war era, and cultural questions seem to be at the forefront of politics in the last decade or two, at least, and perhaps longer than that. So one point that I often make is that if you were allowed to ask a voter one policy question and had to guess which political party they vote for, not just in the United States, but in most Western European democracies, in the 1970s or 80s, you would have asked an economic question, right? You would have, broadly speaking, asked something like, would you rather have higher taxes and a bigger welfare state or lower taxes and a smaller welfare state? And that would have told you whether somebody's voting for Democrat or Republican, for the Social Democratic Party of Germany or the Christian Democratic Party of Germany. Nowadays, I think the best way of guessing whether somebody is going to vote for Democrats or Republicans would be a cultural question. It would be about, to what extent should we crack down on the southern border of the United States? You know, what do you think about trans people in sports or any number of other kinds of cultural questions like that? And I think that that is partially because we are a lot more affluent than we used to be, actually. And despite the serious material concerns that many people have, they are less at the foreground of what everybody's thinking about, because actually people are doing, and I know, you know, often on Twitter it doesn't sound like that, and people are catastrophizing about how badly the younger generation is off and so on, and there's some genuine challenges of housing prices and other things. But people are a lot more affluent than they were 50 years ago. And that's just very, very, very clear from every statistic. And by the way, at this point, people in their 30s have more wealth and have higher levels of property ownership than their parents' generation did at the same age. So that might be kind of one background reason for that shift. You know, whether that shift is also true in the shorter run, I don't know. I mean, 2020 was a weird election because we're in the middle of a pandemic and there's not a lot of historical evidence on how people vote during the during pandemics. So that certainly was at the forefront in certain ways. And the best theory I have heard for how Joe Biden will win the election came from a friend I spoke to recently who said, look, basically what the White House has decided is that if the election is about Joe Biden, they probably lose. If the election is about Donald Trump, they probably win. So the Democrats are going to do what they can to make the election about Donald Trump, which has the advantage of giving them a strategic imperative for a tactical necessity, which is for Joe Biden to not sit in his basement as he did in 2020, but sit in the Rose Garden as he might do in 2024, and not run around the country too much, which clearly he has trouble doing. And of course, Donald Trump and Republicans are incapable of veering from that strategy because Donald Trump is incapable of talking about anything other than himself. And so Donald Trump is going to make the election about Donald Trump. And if Joe Biden also makes the election about Donald Trump, that is the only time I've been optimistic about the outcome of his election in the last months. I think it's the smartest theory about how Democrats might somehow squeak through. But that does go against the countercurrents that people continue to be upset about the economy for reasons we can debate. I think there's some good reasons for it. To some extent, it's a misperception of the economy. But people, I talked about this with Larry Summers, they don't compare inflation to a year ago. They compare prices in the grocery store to 5 years ago, and they have gone up over 5 years, right? They are, I think, very upset about some of this cultural stuff. They don't trust Democrats. It's a bottom line thing. They don't trust that Democrats are sensible, and they don't trust that Democrats think highly of them. But they don't trust Donald Trump either. So it's a tough, genuinely tough call for many reasons, people. And I mistrust Donald Trump more than I mistrust the Democrats. But that is what makes it so difficult, that they say, you know, I don't think things are going great, they're not going terribly, but I just don't trust these people. And I kind of want to tell them, fuck you. I mean, against that stands, if the election comes to be about Donald Trump is not popular in America for very good reason. And that pushes them back towards the Democrats. And who knows how those two countervailing factors are going to balance out.
Yeah. A negative polarization is the single most potent force in American politics. And I would sign on if you said, will the next four elections be mostly determined by who do voters hate more? I think they probably will be, maybe the next 10. Also, we've seen evidence that Joe Biden or his people know this is the strategy. I mentioned the debt relief program. So this is a big program that could help a lot of people. You'd think he'd be clamoring about it. But of course, he announces it during the eclipse when everyone is paying attention to something else. So he knows even his policies that could appeal to people, he knows that just not talking about him or being quiet or whispering those policies so the 30 million Americans who could benefit from them hear about it, but no one else does, he knows that plays into his favor. You're also right. Donald Trump can't help but he's a chaos agent. He gets all the attention, and Americans will probably vote against him. I do also think, you know, in 2020, my analysis of that election was it was legitimate for people to be upset about inflation and to blame Democrats for at least, you know, 2 or 3% of that inflation. I think Larry Summers helped form my opinion about which percent of the inflation Democrats were responsible for. But now, as things actually change, acknowledging that it sticks in people's heads and people aren't entirely rational actors, or maybe they just don't like the fact that cornflakes cost $2 more than it did in 2021. But anyway, my point is, in 2020, people were voting on crime, inflation, and, you know, maybe abortion. Well, crime, really, I like empiricism. It has come down a lot. It's less of an issue. Inflation has come down. I don't know how much it's affecting people's voting or attitudes, but some, it's got to affect it some. And abortion is still, I think, the big issue that will motivate Democrats. And Donald Trump hasn't changed or mediated at all. He never can. So add all that up. If Joe Biden doesn't screw it up too much, and the irony is what you went back to, Joe Biden was too old or maybe not nimble enough to get with the program and be the progressive of 2020. Great. So he knew where for whatever reason, he aligned with the electorate. I do think that a more virile, capable, energetic Joe Biden could be louder and help himself, the Joe Biden of 2014 could, in fact, articulate some policies that maybe people will give him credit for. But given the hand you're dealt, his advisors are, I think, there's all the evidence of they're playing that playbook. Be quiet. Let people vote against Donald Trump. That's how we'll win.
So you've turned around this conversation for much of our the conversation to ask me questions, which is great. But I do want to close with a question for you, which is that we've criticized the media a lot, and we're both trying to do something more constructive, which is to build platforms where we are able to criticize some of the new orthodoxy in institutions like NPR and report on the world and inform our readers or listeners about the world in a way that doesn't fall into those same traps, but without becoming reactionaries, without running all the way in the other direction where, you know, all you do is to criticize those things and you come to agree with anybody who disagrees with that ideology and find yourself in very weird company. How do you do that? And how, in particular, in the form of a daily podcast, do you cultivate that conversation? How do you challenge them in ways that avoid the temptation of falling into groupthink? Tell us a little bit how you've been so successful at this.
First of all, some of it is easy for me because my predilection is towards debate and free inquiry and the exchange of ideas. Most arguments about platforming, I know they're out there, but I don't buy them. And it doesn't occur to me that if you talk to a bad person, badness will spread throughout the world, especially if you give them good questions, which isn't to say I would book anyone on the show, but I'd book almost anyone knowing that, you know, they'd come on knowing that they might face tough to withering questions. So some of it is just how I am, and it's just how I order the world. There are other things that I have to really be strategic about. So a while ago, I was actually listening to an interview with Hannah Gadsby, the comedian, with Mike Birbiglia. And Hannah Gadsby was talking about that there's the text of the work and the theme of the work and the spirit of the work. And that stuck with me because the text is the text, but I like to be informed by the spirit of inquiry and the spirit of questioning ideologies. You could imagine a situation where I had some bad experience with Slate. I used to work at NPR. I think there's all this, you know, we're veering off the course media-wise, and so much of my content is informed by that as the theme. Like, you can't listen to the show without knowing, yeah, Mike hits upon these themes again and again. I consciously don't want to do that show. I want the spirit of that to inform the show. But you could go two or three shows, it's a daily show, without even knowing what my stance is on trans girls in sports. And by the way, I think I know what my stance is, but it might surprise you. It might surprise my listeners. I'll tell you what it is. I think in high school, generally, you should let people play. And when scholarships are at stake, it's a different consideration. Fine. So the spirit of the show should be the media that I loved, where all the best questions, anticipating the audience's questions, are asked. There are no shibboleths. The ideology that would mostly appeal to me as a liberal person does get questioned even harder than the ideology of people I disagree with who we just love to beat up on. So that's another major factor.
Mike, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. A great pleasure. Shall I say a dream come true? We could put it in that category. I love listening to the podcast. You do a great job.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good Fight. Lots of listeners have been spreading the word about the show. If you too have been enjoying the podcast, please be like them. Rate the show on iTunes, tell your friends all about it, share it on Facebook or Twitter. And finally, please mail suggestions for great guests or comments about the show to goodfightpod@gmail.com. That's goodfightpod@gmail.com.
This recording carries a Creative Commons 4.0 international license, thanks to Silent Partner for their song, Chess Pieces.